Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program, brought to you at the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto. My name is Colleen Wilcox, and I am your chair for today. Many thanks to the Bernard Osher Foundation and to the generous support of today's program. It is my pleasure and honor to introduce the film director, the screenwriter, the author of I Remember Nothing and Other Reflections, Nora Ephron. After graduating from Wellesley with a degree in journalism, Nora worked briefly as a White House intern during President Kennedy's administration. She left Washington and spent 5 years as a reporter with the New York Post. Her distinctive point of view on social issues and current events has made her one of the best-known writers and best-selling authors in America. Her laugh-out-loud book, I Feel Bad About My Neck, and Other Thoughts on Being a Woman, was a truthful and witty account covering everything from menopause to her attempts to stop the aging process. The daughter of screenwriters, Nora began writing for the big screen in the mid-70s and soon added producer and director to her distinguished resume. Her best-known works include Heartburn, When Harry Met, Sleepless in, and most recently, Julie and Julia. She has garnered 3 Oscar nominations for the Best Original Screenplay and has been honored by BAFTA and Writers Guild of America. Her next big project is rumored to be a biopic on jazz singer Peggy Lee, starring a Reese Witherspoon. Now, moderating this remarkable program is another remarkable woman, Jane Ganahl. She is a writer. She is a columnist. She is a journalist. She is a feminist, and she is a humorist. She is the co-founder of Litquake and author of Single Women of a Certain Age. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Jane Ganahl and Nora Ephron.
Well, I feel very thoroughly introduced. Maybe the most introduced I've ever been. Welcome, Nora.
Thank you, Jane.
We're best friends. I just met her about 7 minutes ago. I just want to give you a flavor of this book before we go forward. And I'll just read a paragraph from Who Are You? Because it made me LOL, laugh out loud. I know you. I know you well. It's true I always have a little trouble with your name, but I do know your name. I just don't know it at this moment. We're at a big party. We've kissed hello. We've had a delightful conversation about how we are the last two people on the face of the earth who don't kiss on both cheeks. Now we're having a conversation about how phony all the people are who do kiss on both cheeks. Ha 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 ha. You're so charming. If only I could remember your name. It's inexcusable that I can't. You've been to my house for dinner. I tried to read your last book. I know your girlfriend's name, or I almost know it. It's something like Chanel, only it's not. Chantel? That's not it either. Fortunately, she isn't here, so I haven't forgotten both of your names. I'm becoming desperate. It's something like Larry. Is it Larry? No, it's not. Jerry. No, it's not. But it ends in a Y. Your last name, three syllables. Starts with a C? Starts with a G? I'm losing my mind. But a miracle occurs. The host is about to toast the guest of honor. Thank God I can escape to the bar. I think it's very interesting.
And your question is?
your question is. Basically, that's just to set up the tone of this fantastic book, which I believe Kepler's is selling over there, so have at it when it's over, and she will be signing books. I'm just curious. It's curious to me that you were, in one of your essays, you were talking about how much rent you paid in the, was it East Village or West Village in 1962, and yet names of people at parties are a complete blank. And it's so strange to me that memory can do that to us, that can make us remember the most minute details.
The most horrible, trivial details. And all the important ones have just, and they're gone, and there's no retrieving them most of the time. I mean, in the book, I talk about how I met Eleanor Roosevelt when I was a political intern in college, and she certainly was the person who, had you asked me at that point, whom did I admire most in the world, whom would I most want to meet, I would have said her. And all I can remember is that there were drapes. and we got lost on the way. There are probably people I could, who were there. I don't know who they were, but I mean, this sense I have that my life has been wasted on me is very acute. And I will tell you something that just happened the other day, and I do not tell you this to drop a name. I just want to give you an idea of what it's like when you get to a certain age, in case no one tells you. I was reading Lady Antonia Fraser's book about her marriage to Harold Pinter, Sir Harold Pinter, probably, who knows. And I'm reading along in this book about these people, and I get to about page 180 and discover to my shock that she has been to my house for dinner. And I have no memory of it all. And I called up my friend Richard, who was a friend from the days in Washington when she apparently came to my house, and said, "Do you have any memory of this?" And he said, "Yes, I do." And there was a fight between Harold Pinter and somebody who was there who was really good at getting into fights with people, and he stood up and stalked out of the party, and it was all we talked about for months. And I had this kind of, I kind of remember that, kind of, yeah.
Are you sure? So you're sure that she wasn't just dropping your name?
She didn't drop my name. Okay. She dropped the name of my ex-husband.
Those were during the Washington Post marriage days, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Yeah, so maybe she forgot I was there, too.
So really, as great a life as you've had, it may actually be greater than
you know.
It may
be even more fabulous. It probably is, for sure.
Oh, those famous people I met that don't remember.
Well, see, as I said, I didn't mean to make it about name dropping. I just meant it about that moment. Where, and you know what it is when your friends say to you, "Oh, that thing you said about thus and such," and they tell you it, and you think, no, I never said that, but if I said it, I said it much better than that.
One of the things you mentioned in this chapter is how nowadays these gossip magazines, People and Us and everything, are full of people that you don't recognize anymore. And I noticed this myself the other day that you know, when I go to the hair salon and that's all they have there to read, and I'm like, I have no idea who these people are. I don't watch Gossip Girl, so maybe, you know, that's part of my problem, where I'm pushing 62.
Yeah, that's Blake Lively. You don't have to know about her.
Okay, another person I know. It's kind of like I skim very quickly because my brain is so full of useless information already. I just don't want to add to it. But so is this a memory thing, or just, you know, or simply as you get older, you discover that you really don't have to know everything?
Well, you might have to know more than we know, but there is a... I mean, I feel that there are certain things that I'm just refusing to know anything about in the hopes they will go away, like certain wars did in my life, you know, where you kind of go, where is this country? Do I have to learn who its leaders are, really? Mightn't it not just stop, you know? And that's how I feel about the Kardashians.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Ah, brilliant.
And by the way, Glenn Beck. Yeah. You know. Yeah.
He's going to be gone soon. He'll be gone soon. Yeah. We don't have to, like a bad war, we'll just have to remember him or try to. Why do you think young people care more about popular culture than we do at this age? Why is it so much more important to the young to be on top of all this stuff?
Oh, well, I think we were like that.
You think?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
We made ourselves memorize all the TV stars. Maybe there's just so many more.
Oh, I have friends who can sing the themes of every television show from the 60s and 70s, when fortunately I was too old to watch any of them. But I can certainly do the entire repertory of all the people who were singing when I was growing up in the 50s. I know every standard. I know lyrics in a way that is interesting only to me. And I think, and when I came to New York, you knew there were things you had to do in order to be a citizen of the metropolis. You had to read Catch-22, and you had to know what each of those characters were, and you had to have your copy of the Mastering the Art of French Cooking, and you had to make beef bourguignon, or you couldn't be in the conversation, really.
Things like, you know, in California now, you know, Merlot is so last year. But, you know, like every year there's a new wine that if you're not drinking it, you're just... Oh,
what is it this year? I'm in a position to see if it's right.
Pinot Grigio, perhaps.
Pinot Grigio, white wine?
Yeah, yeah.
Really?
I'm
just
baking.
When I gave it up.
Or Sancerre, perhaps. I don't know. You also say this something similar about staying technologically current. I love that what you said about how Twitter was invented just to make us seem old or feel old.
Yeah, that's what I really do feel about it. I'm interested because I feel that as a person, I have worked so hard to seem as if I'm on the cutting edge. And when email came, I was absolutely the seventh or eighth person to do it. I was on America Online so early that I got my own name on it, you know, without a four-digit number after it.
Is that right?
And it was so divine, wasn't it, in the beginning when you had seven or eight friends who were on email? And when that voice said, "You've got mail," your heart leapt. And it was mail. It was mail. It was something you were actually interested in reading. It wasn't from the Democratic National Committee. It wasn't from the Williams-Sonoma people. It was mail. You've got mail. And it never said anything like lunch ? Which is one of the worst emails you can get, because it is going to require a minimum of 9 exchanges to nail down where and when lunch is going to be. I mean, I was really good at that, and I wrote You've Got Mail, and I directed it, and I was a believer in email. And now I feel about it the way you feel about, you know, an ex-boyfriend that you bump into and think, what was the matter with me? You know? So.
Well, at the same time, having had a book that came out just a couple years ago, and I was very pressured by publicists to get with it. It was just before Twitter, thank God. But, you know, Facebook and all of those things, there's a lot of pressure on authors now to not just create a book, but 24/7 be on call to fan the flames and whatnot. But you've resisted that, at least with Twitter.
To the best of my knowledge, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, it's entirely possible that they have something tweeting away in my name, but I don't think so. They definitely have a Facebook page for the book. And I have a Facebook page, but I have no friends.
So. It's not very useful then, is it?
Yeah.
You know, writers actually, it's fairly rare that a writer or an author gets to be famous. And you're one of the few whose name is almost household at this point. What would you say is the weirdest upshot of fame? Is it Nora's meatloaf at the restaurant in
well,
New York?
Well, that's a good part.
Oh, no, it's wonderful, yeah. But it's just odd. I mean, who would imagine they'd have a meatloaf named after
them? I would have imagined that. That's exactly... No, we used to play a game called What Would You Like Named After You, as in Peach Melba. And so I have given quite a lot of thought to... And I go to those delicatessens where they have sandwiches named after people, and I've always wondered what it would be like to have an inedible sandwich named after you. So it was not when I opened the menu of the Monkey Bar in New York and saw the words Nora's Meatloaf, I wasn't surprised by that. I was thrilled. I was completely thrilled, even though it was not my recipe. I have never made meatloaf that way. But I had told the owner of the restaurant that I thought he should serve meatloaf, and he very sweetly named it after me. And it was a fabulous experience because people went to the restaurant and then they wrote me emails saying, had your meatloaf last night. And it was great. And here's what I did not say to them. I had nothing to do with it. It's not my recipe. I did not say those words. I said, thank you. It is good, isn't it? And I practically didn't do any work that day because I felt I had this meatloaf out there. But then the meatloaf bombed. The end of the story is that the meatloaf was taken off the menu, and I felt...
And why did they take it off the menu? It wasn't a big hit, I guess.
The first meatloaf... Well, the chef got bad, and then they fired the chef, and they brought in a new chef, and he made a perfectly good meatloaf, but it just didn't take, I guess. So it was just another failure. Yeah.
But since it wasn't your recipe, you couldn't take it personally.
I couldn't, and yet I still felt that I had bombed.
The chapter that you wrote on your love affair with journalism was, and actually a few other critics have said this, first of all, this book is interesting in that some chapters are sort of single thought, very funny, very accelerated, and the chapter on journalism, oh my goodness, it unfolds like a movie or a short story or a book in its own about your, you know, tracing your roots, and I think it would make a... First of all, I think it would make a fantastic movie for you.
But it has no plot.
You could create it. You could sort of novelize it. No. You know, I mean, yeah. just set a young woman in the situation that you found yourself in and have her triumph and everybody goes home happy. But talk about what you call the institutional sexism at Newsweek. I found that astonishing even as a journalist myself.
You know, I just saw... Diane Sawyer interviewed Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sandra Day O'Connor at Maria Shriver's fabulous thing in Long Beach. And you know, you realize both of them, they're both older than I am, but they both graduated from law school and didn't get a job offer. Hmm. And it wasn't that long ago. And I came to New York in 1962 determined to be a journalist, and I went to an employment agency on 42nd Street, and the woman said, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "I want to be a journalist." And she said, "Do you want to work at Newsweek?" And I said, "Okay." And she sent me there. And 10 minutes later, I was at Newsweek, and they said to me, "Why do you want to work at Newsweek?" Well, I didn't want to work at, I mean, I just wanted to be in journalism in some way. And I said, "Because I want to be a writer." And the man interviewing me said, "Well, women aren't writers at Newsweek." And of course, it would never have crossed my mind to say that's a sexist remark, because we had not invented that word
exactly
yet. And you know, it was the way the world was. We knew that. We all knew. It's what O'Connor and Ginsberg said to Diane Sawyer. I mean, the world worked in a certain way, and you just thought to yourself, well, okay, but then there's me. It wasn't a general way of thinking, like, I think I should get together with a bunch of other women and sue, which is what happened at Newsweek eventually. I just thought, well, I'll be here for a while and then I'll go somewhere where maybe that's not true. But the thing that was weird about it is there was a woman writing at Newsweek. I mean, what he said was entirely untrue, except that she had been hired during World War II, like Rosie the Riveter, when they had to hire a woman because they had run out of guys. Mm-hmm. But they were never making that mistake again. So he said, you know, women aren't writers at Newsweek, and totally ignored the fact that there was one. And you know, that's how it was. And you were on a kind of, you were in a track, you were in the girl track. I was a male girl. Then I was a clipper, which meant that I clipped newspapers and used my brilliant Bachelor of Arts to know that the story about a cure for cancer in St. Louis should probably go to the medicine department. And then I became a checker, a researcher it was called, and, you know, the men would write the pieces and the girls would make sure that every word in them was correct. And it was so institutionalized. It was, and yet, it was the way the world was. And years later, when the lawsuit was filed at Newsweek, when I was long gone, the editor of Newsweek was interviewed by the Times, and he said, "Oh, we don't have a policy here. It's just the way we've always done it." And I really got angry and wrote a letter to Katharine Graham, who was the head of the Washington Post, which owned Newsweek, and said, "I don't know you, but I want you to know that that is not true. There was a policy, and it was articulated, and they knew it perfectly well." I mean, it just made me nuts that he would go, "Gee whiz," you know.
And, our oversight meant to hire women just never happened. Yeah. When you write about this now, kind of looking back, you seem fairly, as you are now, kind of like, well, that's just how it was. But did you ever get angry at the time, or?
Well, no, because I was moving on, you know. I got out of there. I had been there, weirdly enough, it was a pretty good job to have. When I was 6 months out of college and I was a researcher in the Nation Department and I was a political science major, I loved politics. That wasn't a bad job to have 6 months out of college. And then at that very moment, the 114-day newspaper strike began in New York. Only it wasn't a strike, it was a lockout. And all the New York papers closed, all seven of them at the time, and my friend Victor Navasky, who was the editor of a humor magazine, got $10,000 from Arthur Frommer, the Europe on $5 a day guy, to do parodies of the New York newspapers. And we did a parody of the New York Post and a parody of the Daily News. And all kinds of great people worked on it. Calvin Trillin worked on it, and a bunch of other names you might recognize. And it was one of those, you know, 48 hours of total, this is why I live in New York, giddiness. And then they came out. Nobody really knew what they were. It wasn't the Lampoon and the Onion had not prepared anyone for what this thing was. And many people bought it thinking that the strike was over. And then complained immediately to the newsstand dealer that it was not a real newspaper and didn't have the stock tables in it. And so it didn't sell a lot of copies, but the editors of the Post read it, and they wanted to sue. And the publisher of the Post, Dorothy Schiff, said, don't be ridiculous. If they can parody the Post, they can write for it. Mm-hmm. Hire them. And I was offered a tryout at the New York Post, which was then, you know, the least of the seven newspapers in almost every way imaginable, but a great place to work. It had, you know, it was liberal. It had a solid circulation of 340,000 people that were going to buy it day in and day out, no matter what. And it had once been great. I always have had that thing of being just slightly too late at a place where they say, oh, too bad you weren't here 5 years ago. It was really good. But they had a huge number of women on the staff. It was the smallest staff of any New York paper, but they had, you know, maybe 50 reporters, and at least 15 or 20 of them were women, because they had a sob sister tradition. It was an afternoon paper, and it was great. And they trained me. They hired me for the lowest possible price you could hire someone for, and they trained me, and I learned how to write a newspaper article.
I mean, given your love of journalism, has it been painful for you to see so many papers fold and staffs downsized? And do you think there will always be room for actual printed material when it comes to news?
Yes, she said hesitantly.
Right.
Yes, I mean, but when you watch papers like, well, the tragedy of the LA Times and the Chicago Tribune, which are bought by someone whose only qualification for owning a newspaper is that he's rich, and you know, he's an idiot, Sam Zell. He's a complete idiot, and he bought this paper and with full of vows that he was about excellence, and immediately they began cutting back. And you know, those are the other good papers. We all know the New York Times, thankfully, is still a great newspaper, as good as it's ever been. But these other papers get less and less good and less competitive. And then there are lots of papers that fold. And that is really sad.
Well, it's very sad. And it sounds to me like nowadays, it's sort of the small community newspapers are really the ones that will probably always be around, because, you know, you need when you live in Oshkosh, I guess you need the Farming Report or something. I have no idea what I'm talking about. But you know what I mean. I mean, the big newspapers are the ones that always were a little top-heavy with the very expensive staff and whatnot. And having been part of the Chronicle for many years and watched that sort of sag and ultimately start to disappear, it's been a tough time. You have written that you didn't think that you found your voice until your 30s in terms of your writing voice. Why do you think they continue to give columns and opinion piece, you know, platforms to 20-somethings? I feel like 20-somethings are somewhat unformed. You know, I think it really does take a while in the journalism business to acquire what it requires to be.
Yes, but then there are some people who get there much sooner than I did. But I always feel terrible for people who sort of have, what would you call it? They have good personalities and they can tell stories, and then they sit down and try to write it and they don't quite have the craft to do it. And I always think But then don't write about yourself. Write about other things. Report on other things. Learn to acquire the craft before you... I feel very lucky that I didn't try almost anything until I was pretty much ready to do it. Because I could no more have written a screenplay at the age of 22. And I see these kids from film school. Some kid the other night, somewhere where I was, don't ask me where I was, I have no idea, stood up and said, I'm having trouble with my screenplay. 22 years old. I said, well, of course you're having trouble with your screenplay. Why should you be able to write a screenplay at the age of 22? Write a short. Write a scene. I mean, these schools that give these kids some hurdle to jump over that it's way too soon. What's he going to write a screenplay about? I'll tell you what. Summer camp. You know? That's why there are so many movies about summer camp, by the way.
Yeah. I think you're right about that. You made the jump fairly, I shouldn't say easily, because it was, you know how easily it was, but successfully, from writer to screenplay writer. And, you know, non-writers may think, oh, well, you write one thing, you write another. But no, it's a very, very different craft. It's like going from writing nonfiction to fiction. And
but, you know, my first movie was my seventh script.
Because you had written several that didn't get
made. Yeah, I mean, I wrote one script that became a horrible television movie, really bad. But because it had been made, I got assignments to write other scripts. But I couldn't get a movie made until Silkwood got made. And Silkwood got made in large part because Meryl Streep wanted to make it.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is... And, I mean, you know, I wrote scripts that were sort of also good, but they didn't come together in the way that did.
Where are those now? Sitting in a vault
someplace? In the very sad place called my closet.
Yeah. I don't know.
That's a big difference between print mm-hmm. and movies. Because all the years I was mostly in print, people would call and they'd say, oh, we're doing a something. Do you have anything in the closet? Do you have anything in the famous trunk that no one has anymore? I mean, a trunk. And I said, no. I mean, if I write something, I can get it printed. And then you go into the movie business, and it's just a bunch of sad
stacked with
dead babies. It's really sad. Yeah.
What made you decide to become a director?
Well, many things, many, many things. One, I hardly know what order to put them in. One was that I was, even though I now call myself, well, I was getting older. I was getting older for the movie business. And I was in my late 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, by the way, right before I was going to direct my first movie, my sister Delia and I had written what we thought was a hilarious script about the Archie comics. And the executive at Warner Brothers said, how would you feel about our bringing a younger, hipper writer onto this?
Wow.
Yeah.
Ow.
Anyway, it was one of those... Oh. By then, I was sort of astute enough to actually just cut him off at the knees at that moment, but unlike the man who interviewed me at Newsweek. But he was saying what the truth is. But if you direct a movie, if you direct your script, then you have a better chance of it getting made. Directors don't wash out of the business as young as writers can. So that was one reason. Another reason was I wanted to write about women. And at the time I started directing, if you were handed a list of all the... You know, one of the hardest things when you write a script is getting a director to marry it, to getting a director to commit to your movie. And the way I learned to do it is that you try to invest whoever you're working with in the script to the point where you will use his most recent divorce in it, just anything, anything to make him feel the movie's about him. And we put, you know, Mike Nichols' breakup with one of his girlfriends is in Silkwood. And of course, When Harry Met Sally is, I based that character completely on Rob. I thought, I'll get him. He'll actually make the movie if I do this. Well, if you write a movie about a woman who has a career and children, and then your agent gives you the list of the possible directors on it, and there are 100 names on it, and one of them is Lena Wertmüller, and the other, well, I mean, there were maybe two other women on the list. One of them was Barbara Streisand. Do you know, it was, it, if you're going to write about women, well, and who's going to direct that movie? I'm a person with children and a career. I should direct that movie. So that was a good reason. And the other reason is that if, you know, a movie like When Harry Met Sally, I knew when I wrote that script that it was a good movie for someone's first movie, in that most of it took place indoors and had 2 to 4 characters in every scene. And it was a kind of, it wasn't hard in terms of knowing where the camera was supposed to be and things like that. But then Rob directed it, and it was so much better than what I could have done. But I also made a couple of movies, wrote a couple of movies that weren't better than the script. And I thought, well, I could have screwed that up just as well as the person who did and made a lot of money. So all of that stuff meant that I thought, well, it might be fun. And I am really, as any of you who know anything about me know, I am sort of bossy, which is a really good thing for a director. And so it was all that stuff. I was very lucky to get the script made, though. I was asked to do it by a woman named Dawn Steele, who was running a studio, and she was fired. And the script was left with the men who came into the studio and took it over, one of whom was a very famous person named John Peters, who was a hairdresser who then went out with Barbara Streisand. And I had a meeting with him, and I think it was the low point of my life in the movie business, and there have been a lot of them.
Low points.
And he said to me, I've made 68 movies, and I have never read a script. And I don't need to read a script. What's yours about? And I looked, I thought, well, this is really going to be interesting to him, a woman balancing her career and her children. But fortunately, he had a girlfriend named Vendela. Does anyone remember Vendela, the model? Vendela...
Swedish.
He pulled her into the room to listen to it because she was a woman and someday she might have children. And it was grim. It was really, really grim and sad. So it kind of sat at that studio for a while, and I really, really thought, oh, I'm never going to... It was like a, you know, a sort of dot on the horizon, and I was never going to get there. And I had a wonderful agent named Sam Cohn, who was just one of the great legendary figures in the movie business, who would call me up every month and he would say, I dreamed you directed your movie. And it's going to happen. And it was incredibly sweet of him because Sam, we had actually modeled a character in the movie on Sam. Sam was very famous for, among other things, the fact that while you were at lunch with him, he would eat the napkin. He would just... It was so weird, I cannot tell you. Anyway, we had a character that Dan Aykroyd actually eventually played, a person who eats paper. But anyway, A man who ran Fox, Joe Roth, bought the script and let me make it, and that's what I got really lucky with being a director. So,
You've had some huge hits, you know, When Harry Met Sally and Sleepless in Seattle, and You've Got Mail. You've also had a few less than successful ones, and I just wonder how hard is it to get back up off the mat and, you know, keep slugging after you've gotten bad reviews or if a movie doesn't do good business or whatnot?
Well, it's not easy, and it's probably a little harder if you're a woman. They're a little happier to wash you out completely if you're a woman, and I'm not a victim-y sort of person, but I think that's just a true thing. But I feel lucky because I'm a writer, so I felt that I could always write my way back in. Mm-hmm. If I could just get the next assignment. So I've been lucky in that way. But there's a piece in the book about failure and how much more of your brain a failure takes up. And by the way, this isn't just true about movies. It's true about, you know, relationships and friendships and jobs and all those things. Success is something you barely ever think about. You know, you might pop a champagne cork and say, this is great. But failure, you brood and you brood. And what should I have done? And if only I had said, and I should never have agreed to, and all those things. And I have to say it has become easier for two reasons. One is that you do learn that a few days later, the only person really thinking about it is you. And the other reason is Ambien. Yeah.
So. Vitamin A, yes. I've actually heard it called that by a friend. I'm going to sort of rotate in a few questions from the audience. Here's a cute one about if your life was made into a movie, who would you like to play you?
Oh, you know, the really great thing about my life is that for the last 30 years, it has had no plot.
This is a more serious question. How and where do you find the courage to write and reflect on the troubled relationship with your mother?
Oh, well, it took me a long time to write. I've written about my mother in varying ways. There's a section in Heartburn that's kind of my mother, but not. I think it felt like it was something I could write about. It's a piece in the book that is among other things about that thing where you have a very powerful parent who then becomes an alcoholic in my mother's case, or becomes anything else. But the point is the unbelievable dilemma of putting those two things together in your head, the person that you worshipped and adored, and I would never, ever be in this chair but for her. I mean, she was a screenwriter. She wanted all four of her daughters to be writers, and all four of us are writers.
That's extraordinary.
That's amazing. And she really knew how to turn us into writers, and she did it. And all the books that, you know, the only thing she ever did, she had a Studebaker, a 1948 Studebaker that 10 years later, when she sold it, had something like 6,000 miles on it. And the only place she ever took it were to the secondhand bookstores on La Cienega Boulevard in Los Angeles, where she would buy us the books she had loved as a kid or the books she thought we had to read. So all of that was so powerful and so unlike other people's mothers, because she worked in the first place and because of this thing she had that I always tell everyone about, which is that if you came to her with a sad story, she had no interest in it whatsoever. She would say, everything is copy, everything is material, someday you will think this is funny. I know you don't believe me, but it's true. And it's a very cold kind of mothering. It's the complete, it's almost counterintuitive. It's, it, as a mother, I find it amazing that she did it, because your instinct, your absolute instinct, is to say, oh, honey, I'm so sad. I feel bad that happened to you. I know what that must, not my mother. None of that. Turn it into a story. Turn it into a funny story. Get back to me. I will be interested. And, and, but, you know, it is not a bad lesson to teach kids that you can get over things and that you should watch them while they're happening, because at some point something else will happen. And so, anyway, there was that person, and then there was the drunk that she became, a nightmare alcoholic. And it was utterly confusing, you know, because we were so proud of her, because nobody had a mother like this. Nobody had a mother with, you know, very beautiful, beautiful clothes, wrote plays, wrote movies, and had four children. And was, by the way, there. It wasn't, I know there were a lot of women in her, there were other working women in her age bracket who were out, you know, traveling around the country. She was home, my parents were home every single night for dinner. They went out maybe once a week. Dinner was our religion growing up. 6 o'clock in the den, and then dinner, three courses, and conversation, and it better be good.
Make it snap, right?
Yeah.
Yes, you did write that your mother sort of reminded you that everything's copy. And in terms of your own work, you draw the line with your current husband, but not with your former, obviously. What was
yeah.
What was Bernstein's reaction to Heartburn?
He was not happy.
Next question. No, yeah. I'm just kidding. No, I can imagine he wasn't.
Yeah, he's still not happy. He's you know. Whatever.
Yeah. Ancient history, people.
Yeah.
Question about whether you have a favorite story of your brief time at the Kennedy White House.
Well, I was a political intern in Pierre Salinger's office in 1961, and I was finally forced to write about this because yet another woman in the Kennedy White House, an intern, in fact, was revealed to have had an affair with him. And I realized, not for the first time, that I was the only woman who had worked in the White House that he had not made a pass at. And so I wrote a piece that was not very long, because my memories are, I only remember the high points of my relationship with him, and they were few and far between. But my favorite moment was, I had met him, and then I had nothing to do in this job, nothing. I mean, I didn't even have a desk. And so I would sort of lurk around and read the files and go to the press briefings every day. I learned, actually, you don't always learn what you think you're going to learn in a job. And what I learned in that job was that I did not want to work in Washington. Mm-hmm. That was absolutely clear, that there were no good jobs for women there. Speaking, it was just like Newsweek, and then all the men had the good jobs and all the women worked for them. But anyway, on Friday afternoon, a thing you did, if you had nothing to do, was watch the helicopter land when it came to take the president to Hyannisport for the weekend. Big thing. So I was out on that sort of, that landing that overlooks the Rose Garden, where you see all those ceremonies that happen, and we were all looking over at the main part of the White House, at the portico, and And the helicopter landed, making all this noise. And suddenly, right here, the president came out of the Oval Office. I had no idea he was in the Oval Office. And he walked past me, a bunch of people, and he suddenly saw me. And the helicopter was going madly around, and he said, "How are you coming along?" And I said, "What?" That was it. That was all it was. And I really, you know, I knew at the time that was a funny story. I have to tell you that. Yeah.
Well, it's not a very satisfying anecdote, but it's something. This might be sort of a trick question. Since you remember nothing, do you remember being voted the best politician in your senior high school class?
I do. Yeah.
I don't know how this someone person knew that.
I want someone were... must have gone to Beverly Hills High School in this room. Yeah.
Someone wondering, they have a daughter in film school at NYU, and if you have any advice for young women.
Yeah.
I missed her face. Was she going, "Don't"?
Well, no. I just, you know.
Entering the film industry today, is there anything you would tell your younger self if it were...
Oh, well, I didn't enter the movie business till I was in my late 30s. And so I always, in my own completely narcissistic way, tell people they should go into journalism and learn something before they go into the movie business. But I am not successful in this. And anyway, there are no jobs in journalism.
Right.
So, but I'm afraid that whoever's daughter it is probably has to move to L.A. to do it, because there's just not a whole lot going on in New York. It's hard to get jobs there. I don't know what she wants to do or be. Acting she can do somewhat in New York, but then at a certain point she'll go to L.A. for that too.
And there's, you know, there's all kinds of jobs in the film industry too. From it seems like there's a lot more women editors, film editors.
There have always been a lot of film editors yeah. who are women. Yeah, but not everybody has a gift for that. That's a very, very technical
major skill.
I don't mean it isn't that the people who don't do it are brilliant, but it really requires a kind of fantastic brain of, I mean, I'm wildly admiring of editors. I just can't get over what they can do.
When you direct movies, do you go in the editing room and just sort of see how they do their thing?
Well, what happens, especially now that everything is edited on computer, it used to be that you would go into the editing room. If you're the director, you go in and you would look at a scene or something and you'd say, "Let's do this, this, and this, and let's look at the footage of this." And the editor would have to go over to a Steenbeck, it was called, and hand put the reel of film on it. And then you would leave your editor with some instructions, and about 2 days later you could come back, and meanwhile you could do anything you felt like.
Uh-huh.
But now, because it can be done so much faster on the computer, you're basically in the editing room every single day for the 10 weeks after you finish shooting a movie until you have to finish your cut. And it's actually fun, except the first 4 weeks of it aren't. Yeah.
I forget which comedian or director they asked, you know, "Is it hard to make movies?" He said, "Well, the hardest part is punching those little holes like that." Who would that have been? Who's a comedian? Was it Woody Allen, maybe? I don't know. I want to get back for just a minute to your last book. Somebody wrote that you enhanced your own glamour, which is considerable, by writing about becoming dowdy. Do you see the irony in that? I think that's probably quite true and very funny.
I don't know who wrote that. What did you...
Was, I think,
you mean because I wrote about my neck?
Yeah, about the you know, downside of aging and whatnot.
Yeah, well, I don't know what that is. I mean, I was just writing the kind of thing I always write, which is that I'm always looking for something to say that people don't say, but that when they read it, they'll go, why has no one said this before?
Right.
This
exactly.
is a good thing to do when you write an essay. And I was amazed to discover some of the things I feel I am a, you know, Vasco da Gama of old age, in that people don't tell you the truth. They really don't say how complicated aging is, and there's just nothing but books about your happy golden years, and I don't know what they're about, you know?
Well, you know, there's this the opinion out there that women should age gracefully and accept, you know, these things, these lines around our eyes, these baggy eyelids and whatnot. And it's just a constant dilemma for women my age, you know, to, cause yeah, we're proud of what age we are, but holy cow. Like, remember when I used to not have these things up here? And you don't want to be vain, but on the other hand,
why don't you want to be vain? Well, you do want to be vain. You just have so much less to be vain about.
That's it's true.
Just, you know.
I'm going to put that on my Facebook page, what Nora Ephron said to me today. You're entitled to be vain. You just have less to be. No,
We don't want to be vain. You're so vain, vain. But that moment when you suddenly realize that you have walked past a mirror and put your hand up to shield yourself from the possible shock of what has happened to your face since you left the house, you know.
Goodness.
Yeah.
Here's one that's, I think, intended to elicit a quick and visceral reaction. Sarah Palin, 2012. Question.
Yeah, I know. Listen, I mean, I don't. It's really bad, isn't it?
It's
yeah.
Very.
Yeah.
Last thing I heard.
I'm looking forward to finding her funny.
I'll drink to that. Yes. Yeah. Apparently, Barbara Bush just said some comment like, you know, well, I hope she goes back to Alaska and stays there, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, Barbara Bush, she's a confusing one, isn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I read the first chapter of George Bush's book because I was so interested in that fetus thing.
Fetus thing?
That thing where he says his mother kept the...
Oh,
well,
that's
the sea
right,
was
right.
covered that she had a fetus in a jar, and I thought it was sort of like strawberry preserves, and she kept it in the kitchen, but that isn't quite what happened. But I never know what to do about her because she so irritates me when it turned out we all knew she was pro-choice and that she wouldn't say so. I just hate that about them. I do. Yeah.
They have to, you know, there's... The old lockstep thing is alive and well among Republicans, I think.
Yeah. It's not a good time.
It's not a good time.
Yeah.
Did you have a sense of deflation after the recent elections?
Or? I did. Yeah. I think it's grim.
Don't you think it's possible, though, that you know, the pendulum has to swing?
I know. That's what everyone has said. And not only does the pendulum have to swing, but people have to say that the pendulum has to swing. But
in order to make themselves sleep at
night. You know, what if it doesn't?
Yeah.
You know, or I mean, do you realize if McCain had been elected, there would now be six people on the Supreme Court willing to overturn Roe v. Wade.
I know.
So,
it gives one pause.
Yeah.
I love when you write in this book about the things that were told are good for us and once thought were good for us, or everything is sort of flip flopped. Teflon bad. Egg whites good, except they're not really good. Chicken soup made you sick, basically. Instead of making you feel better. And
well, I'm not against egg whites. I'm against egg whites with
omelet?
No egg yolks along with them.
The egg white omelet.
The egg white omelet. If any of you is having an egg white omelet, you think you're doing something virtuous. You are simply misinformed. And you're eating something tasteless that will do nothing whatsoever to help your cholesterol count. It's called the informational cascade, when something is said mm-hmm. so often that people think it's true. But the truth is that dietary cholesterol does not affect your cholesterol count. Eating too much affects your cholesterol count. And I feel bad for you if you ever order an egg white omelet again.
It's tempting to ask a girly question like how you... She's one of the original foodies, and yet she stays, like, whippet thin. What do you
whippet,
do?
Whippet, I like that. Yeah. That's good, yeah.
What's thinner than a whippet, really?
Yeah. How do I... What do
just,
I do?
Yeah, is it just very conscious
eating? I think about
eating?
Food all day long.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. And I think about at what point I'm going to be able... I mean, I... If I have something really good for breakfast, then I know that it's just not going to be good for lunch, there is nothing easy about this. I have been on a diet since I was 19 years old and gained 20 pounds my first year at Wellesley and came home pathetic, and fat, and by the way, not shapelier, just wider. And
more like a brick.
And yeah, I lost the weight. I had a really good doctor who put me on a high-protein diet, and I have been on one ever since. So that's how I do it.
I believe we're actually down to our last question. And just to end with a kicker, would you say that your personal philosophy in life is something along the lines of have more pie because you're dwindling, which was in your book, which I loved?
Well, certainly it's, I mean, that's one way you could boil it down if you had to six words. But, well, no, what I really do believe, and this is extremely, there are two chapters in my book. One is called What I Won't Miss. And then the last chapter is called What I'll Miss. And the last thing on that list is pie. And I really think that at a certain point in your life, you have to know that if things are okay, at some point they won't be. And in the meantime, do all the things that you say you want to do when you have those hypothetical conversations about what your last meal is going to be, because when it comes time to have your last meal, you're going to be too sick to eat it. Or you're not going to know it's your last meal and you're going to make the mistake of having a tuna melt, you know? So do it now. Bite it off while you can, because you know... This is the truth about our lives at a certain point, and you can't pretend that it's not, and you can't... I'm a big one on denial, but I'm not big about... I really carefully think, is this somebody... This person that I sometimes have dinner with always makes me feel bad, mm-hmm. always gives me a little zingo. I think I'm not going to have dinner with them. You know, or this hot dog from Nate and Al's Delicatessen on Beverly Drive in Beverly Hills is the greatest meal on the planet, and I'm going there for lunch, even if I regret it the entire afternoon. So, you know, so yes, have pie
philosophy.
Now while you're dwindling, right. Okay.
Well, thank you, Nora Ephron, very
thank
much.
Thank you, Jane. Thank you so much.
It was a wonderful conversation.
Well, I just happen to know that you did enjoy this afternoon's program as much as I did. And, of course, it was brought to you by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. I have lots of thank yous. I would like to thank our absolute delightful Nora Ephron, current author of I Remember Nothing and Other Reflections. I would like to thank Jane Ganahl, author of Single Women, of a certain age. Certainly the Bernard Osher Foundation, our audience here in Palo Alto, and for those of you joining us on the radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, Silicon Valley, celebrating over 100 years of celebrated, enlightened discussion, is regrettably adjourned.